Today's program was brought to you by Whole Foods Market. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
You are listening to You Look Hungry, the New Orleans Sessions. You are listening to You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Helen Holliman, and I'm broadcasting live out of New Orleans, Louisiana. I'm joined today by Lolas Eli, a man of many, many things. Let's see, where do we begin? How can we...
I guess we begin with journalism, then we go into television writing, food writing, and... That's most of it, you know, ancillary things beyond that.
Well, so, let's see. Most recently, you've joined the staff of HBO's Tremé as a writer. You have co-produced and written the documentary for PBS called Faubourg Tremé, The Untold Story of Black New Orleans. You had a weekly column for the Times-Picayune. You're hands down one of the best food and culture writers in New Orleans. And your works have been seen in the Oxford American, Gourmet, The New York Times, The Washington Post. I mean, the list goes on and on. Mm-hmm. So, thanks for coming on the show.
Pleasure's mine.
So, you know, I guess straight off the bat, you know, we're sitting in Tremé at the moment, and you're a native New Orleanian. You were writing about food, and now you're working on the show. How has that transition been from working at the Times Pick to writing for the show?
The thing that has made the transition relatively easy is that the things that David Simon and Eric Overmeyer want to write about in Tremé, want to put on television through Tremé, are many of the same things that interested me and that I wrote about at the paper. So the music, the architecture, the culture, the stories of people other than the politicians, or other than the folks who are most famous and who you're most apt to read about in the headlines. So in that sense, it's taking the same kinds of things I wanted to talk about and putting them into a new genre, a new medium. That transition has been made easy in part because Dave and Eric knew from the beginning I'd never written for television before. So in that sense, they have been patient with me, taught me a lot. And so the transition has not been too bad.
So... For a lot of listeners out there, how do you properly pronounce Tremé? Because there's many... I've heard a lot of people say Treem, you know, tuning in from various states. Can you talk about the pronunciation and where the word comes from?
Treem is definitely and categorically incorrect. The name comes from Claude Tremé, a Frenchman who married a wealthy woman who owned a lot of land in New Orleans. And after they got married, he proceeded to sell much of it off. And the family has some question as to whether or not the city paid what it was supposed to pay or the deal was done properly. But nonetheless, it is named after him. On his tomb, there are accents over both E's, the T-R-E-M-E, which would mean in French it would be Tremé. Each E pronounced A. But of course, a lot of people who live here pronounce it Tremé. And then you got Tremé, as we pronounce on the show, which is sort of T-R-U-H-M-A-Y, Tremé. I actually have a podcast on the NOLA.com website of me talking to their TV writer about the various pronunciations. In New Orleans, you always have options in terms of pronunciation. You know, it could be French, it could be American, it could be Creole, or it could be New Orleanian.
How do you say it?
Tremé.
Tremé. Me too. It's easy. I can't speak French, so I'll butcher it. But so, your documentary, how did that project come about? And can you talk about what it's all about?
Don Logson came to me wanting to do a documentary about this neighborhood. And she was fascinated with the extent to which it remained an important arts community with musicians, writers, and building artisans living and working in the community. I told her that, you know, I'd be glad to help her out, but I didn't know how much time I'd have, and bit by bit I got roped in and realized what a brilliant idea she had. What we jointly realized is that our idea of telling you a little bit about the prehistory of this community, about the literary salon of the 1800s, about the fights for civil rights prior to the Civil War, about the long legacy of folks in the building trades, in visual arts, and in music. We wanted to give you enough of that to then see the connections in present-day Treme. But the more we looked at the history in the 1800s, the more we realized that nobody knew it, and that it ran counter to the narrative that most Americans have about what it meant to be black and in or near slavery in the 1800s. This has long been a large population of free people of color here, who in many instances were fairly wealthy and fairly influential, which is not to minimize the degree to which they suffered from extreme racism, and not to minimize the sort of strange juxtaposition you find yourself in being black and free in a community of slave people. But nonetheless, people had not realized the extent to which the struggle for democracy in this nation began not after the Civil War, not with Martin Luther King, but in the 1820s and 30s with these people, and they were fighting until the 1890s when they brought the Plessy versus Ferguson case to the Supreme Court. And of course, that case is noted for two things: separate but equal, the doctrine that then ruled the country, was established in that court case. But the most famous dissent in Supreme Court history is the one from that case, where the justice says, in essence, nobody's going to be fooled by this. You can't have separate but equal, and this is pure injustice. And of course, that was the argument that won the day in the 1950s and 60s with Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King and those people.
So can you talk about some of your favorite people in Treme history, like in doing the documentary? Some really like unique characters.
Well, we focus on a man named Paul Tremaine, whose grandfather, we believe, was of Spanish descent, moved here from Saint-Domingue, and much of the family was in the building trades. He was the editor of the first two black newspapers, Le Union and the Tribune, and he's really the focus of the story. One of my personal heroes is a man named Rodolphe Desdunes, in part because Desdunes was younger than what he called the generation of 1860. Those men were grown by the time of the Civil War and therefore in a position to be really influential and to try to bring democracy to a nation that had not known it. Well, here it is after Plessy versus Ferguson, and everybody's very much dispirited because this was the one time when we're going to say to the United States, is it going to be democracy or not? And the Supreme Court said not. So people felt that it was hopeless. So the migration out to California, out to Mexico, back to Haiti, a lot of people were doing that between 1860 and 1900. Rodolphe Desdunes decided to write a book called Nos Hommes, Nos Histoires, Our People, Our History. And in it, in a bunch of vignettes, he talks about some of the heroes of that era, Paul Tremaine being chief among them, but Edmond Dédé, the composer, some other visual artists, Dubla Clay, and other people he mentions. And that's an important inspirational book because he's attempting to capture this history at a point when it is very much in danger of being lost. And often that was my conception of what I was doing, not only at the Times-Picayune, when many of my columns would be about history and about aspects of New Orleans history you might not otherwise know, but even in the context of doing Smokestack Lightning and the barbecue book, the fact that everybody in this town or in this community knew that this guy was the greatest barbecuer, I thought that was something that was worth celebrating. Or to paraphrase Death of a Salesman, attention needed to be paid to those types of achievements in the culinary world.
So speaking of Smokestack Lightning, talk about that book and how it came about.
I was on the road as a road manager with Wynton Marsalis Band, and Frank Stewart, a photographer, was working in the band as well. He and Wynton were doing a book together, and he and I decided we would do a book together at some point. We went through various possibilities of what we would do, and Frank, who grew up in Memphis and Chicago, suggested that we would do a book on barbecue. And I wrote up a book proposal, which is laughable now, but basically it was going to be us going to various states kind of looking at regional differences, but I had no idea what these differences were or what they meant. And we decided that we would start off in Memphis, at Memphis in May, because it was familiar ground for him, and Memphis in May was a big festival, an important festival. And so we'd be in Memphis, both at the festival, driving around the city to see what else was going on, and even driving outside of town. In the course of all this driving, we listened to this old blues music, ranging from Robert Johnson up to Howlin' Wolf and B.B. King and Muddy Waters and those people. I began to see a connection between rural music and rural food versus urban of each, and the idea that these transitions can be seen as paralleling each other, going from whole hog barbecue to just the ribs, just the sandwiches, going from acoustic music to electric music, etc. So in that sense, I began to formulate this notion of barbecue as a metaphor for American culture. And that guided the book. And it's an imperfect metaphor, and there are points where that argument is made more strongly than others. But the other idea was that it would be a road book. It'd be two guys trying to discover something about this country. And then the final result would be a statement about the nation that went beyond the plate, beyond the specifics of barbecue.
What is your idea of perfect barbecue?
The problem with that question is, for most of us, you go to a city, taste a regional barbecue that you may not be familiar with, you don't like it, and you conclude that all the barbecue around here is terrible. The good thing about being forced to do that book is we had to keep tasting until we found something good. And I can say honestly, because you know, I'm speaking vaguely enough not to offend anyone, but in every region that we went, we found good barbecue. Texas, I thought, as a state, was the most consistent, which irks me because, you know, I'm from Louisiana, so we got our rivalry. But what I really look for is good smoke flavor. I like fall off the bone tender more than I like the more chewy variety. On brisket, I like the fat end. For pork sandwiches, I prefer pulled to chopped. And I prefer to do all the seasoning with dry spices and a little bit of sauce or marinate. But for the most part, don't slather this in sauce. Most of the time I order without the sauce.
So is there any spot in New Orleans that you really like to check out, or around New Orleans?
The New Orleans scene is really getting much, much better. What's the name of that place? The Joint, I think. Is quite good. And Uptown Squeal, I think, does some really good stuff. I was at this food and wine event yesterday and had some food from Fat Hen Grill, which I'm anxious to try a bit more of because what I had was quite good. But what that really says is that barbecue is becoming increasingly national. My argument is that New Orleans didn't have much in the way of barbecue because we had so much else, and it was not something we focused on. Whereas, particularly in the Southeast, the idea of barbecued pork, this is the holy grail of the regional cuisine. But at this point, I think capitalists are saying, I got some money, I want to do a restaurant, what concept do I want to do? And therefore, barbecue is not merely limited to the people who love it and figure they got a good recipe that the world needs to have. It's people saying, you know, what this country needs, or what this city needs, or this neighborhood needs, is this particular kind of place. So New Orleans is following a national trend in that regard.
Why do you think before there wasn't barbecue?
In New Orleans?
I
just think this is a seafood-centric town. And so we had other traditions going on. We have our pork traditions with pickled pork as our primary seasoning, making smoked sausage, obviously. And there are people in the backyards who did a good job. But you got to have a lot of people doing it on a mediocre level to have a few people really excelling.
So, okay, we're in Treme. So I am curious, where do you like to eat in the neighborhood?
My two favorites are Dookie Chase and Willie Mays. Miss Chase hates doing a buffet because she has a very elegant sense of what a good restaurant should be. But nonetheless, I have had some excellent food on her Friday lunch buffet. And also, she's such an icon and has been important to me and my parents for a long time. And Willie Mae Seton, it's interesting because my first job was at the storeroom in the Superdome. And that summer, I worked with one of her grandsons, Kenny. And fast forward, I start going there. And anytime a food writer would come to town, you know, Bud Trillin, Ed Levine, Jeffrey Steingarten, I'd bring them to Willie Mays because, one, it was my favorite fried chicken. Two, many of these kind of neighborhood small restaurants I don't like anymore. A lot of the stuff they're doing is kind of canned or mass-produced, and most of what Willie Mays does is done from scratch. And the chicken, until it got so busy or late, the chicken was always done per order. So those are the two places that I am really excited about even now, and they're both now 40, 50 years old.
I mean, I think Willie Mays is the best fried chicken in America, hands down. Mm-hmm. And it's got that, like, creme brulee kind of crust that's crazy. It's so good.
Yeah.
We're going to take a really quick break, but when we get back, we've got more from Lola's Eli. You're listening to You Look Hungry. Keep it locked.
Foods Market, we believe in healthy snacking, eating our veggies, and supporting local. Check out Brad's Raw Chips, a local producer that created irresistible chips after their namesake's successful weight loss with a raw lifestyle. Their chips are gluten-free, nutrient-packed, and so good that you'll think you're indulging. For more information, visit bradsrawchips.com.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm still your host, Helen Holliman, and I'm joined today by Lola's Eli in New Orleans, Louisiana. Before the break, we were discussing food in New Orleans, life in Treme, past and present, HBO Treme, and so much more. And I can't stop talking about fried chicken because I want to talk a little bit about your role in Willie Mays after Katrina.
It was an amazing turn of events in the, you know, 6 months before and after the storm. As I was saying, anytime a food writer would come to town, I'd bring them to Willie Mays because the fine dining restaurants everyone already knew about, and many of the neighborhood restaurants weren't that great, but I'd bring everyone there. And ultimately, some of the people on the James Beard Restaurant Committee decided that she'd be perfect for an America's Classics Award. And so here it is in May of 2005, and I'm accompanying her up to New York, where she'd been only once, sort of passing through. And so we also raised some money to help defray her expenses, and took her on sort of a grand tour of New York. We went to Union Square Cafe, and the chef came out and spoke with us, and we did a bunch of stuff. Then we get ready to go to the James Beard Awards. It was sort of beautiful the way it worked out because she was seated kind of in the back. And when they announced the award, she starts walking up. But, you know, she didn't walk very fast. And once you saw that she was sort of struggling to get up there, the applause just gets more and more intense. And the emotion is rising even more than that. So she finally gets up to the stage to what is by then a standing ovation. And she can't speak. And it's interesting because she's normally not shy, not retiring, but at that moment she could barely do anything but cry and say thank you. So she comes back to New Orleans, and you know, I did a story in the Times-Picayune about this. Everything is going well. And Hurricane Katrina happens. And the levees fail. And there's probably 4 feet of water in her restaurant. So they evacuate. She's in Texas. She's been successful, I think, in part because she's so incredibly headstrong and won't take advice, even if it's well-meaning or perhaps good advice. She gets on a plane, comes back here, takes a taxi to her restaurant, kind of sits outside and trying to figure out what to do. And it's, of course, even a crazy and quixotic question to ask, because even if her restaurant was perfect, nobody's back by then. But her idea is that she has a son who could do the repairs and get her back open. Well, her son at that point is in his mid-70s, so he ain't as strong as he used to be. Finally, the homeless patrol, for lack of a better word, the people deal with homelessness in an OPD, are driving around and see her. And they've made arrangements to have a couple of rooms in a hotel for either officers who need a place to stay or cases like Willie Mays. So she is sitting there with her James Beard Award medal. And so she's telling the officers about this and so forth. At that point, she's a little out of it. They call the James Beard people. The James Beard people call John T. Edge, one of the people I had brought to Willie Mays. And John T. calls me, and we begin to try to figure out what to do. Ultimately, she is staying with friends, crying incessantly about how badly she wants to be back in a restaurant, still under the impression that basically you go in and you put a little paint on the walls and you're okay. So October, Southern Foodways Alliance symposium takes place in Oxford, Mississippi. And John Edgerton, who is truly one of the great men this nation has produced, he has bought a bunch of pickles from these pickle manufacturers in Kentucky. And whatever the deal was, he in essence was selling for, I think, $15 a jar, all the proceeds gone to whatever SFA wanted to do to help with the rebuilding of Katrina. As an organization, I've now forgotten their name. They had this idea they would go and rebuild key institutions in devastated neighborhoods as a sort of way of getting other people to follow suit and come back. So they decided to do Willie Mays. Somebody told them about Willie Mays and about me. I went and met with him, and we were going back and forth several times. They sent their engineers and so forth down to figure out what to do. Ultimately, they didn't have the capacity to actually do this rebuilding, but they became the catalyst to get the Southern Foodways Alliance involved. And so we were raising money. We were trying to get volunteer brigades to come down, which we managed to do. And it became clear that nothing had been done in terms of major repairs or renovation on that restaurant in probably 10, 20, 50, 25 years. And so it wasn't a matter of repairing post-flood damage. It was a matter of really evaluating what it's going to take to make this a good restaurant in terms of health and safety standards. The bills go up and up. And there are a few real heroes in that. The biggest one was John Kearns, about whom or to whom enough praise cannot be heaped. He was coming out here several weekends a month. He and his father working in there sometimes alone, trying to rebuild that restaurant when he had his own concerns as well. After, I don't know, a long time, the restaurant is ready to open. And in the film that Joe York did about it, it's an amazing scene where Willie May, after all these years of complaining, realized that she didn't have the energy to do it anymore. And she literally asked me if I want the restaurant. Well, the good news is that her great-granddaughter, Carrie, steps in. And Carrie had worked there for years, and their relationship had been imperfect, in part because Willie May wanted to run everything. But Carrie has since taken it. And one of the things that happened, in part because of the Southern Foodways Alliance, she started working at Restaurant August with John Besh. So her concept of what a restaurant was or could be was certainly informed in part by that experience. So what she's done since then has been incredible. Willie May is now no longer able to work in the restaurant at all, but it's thriving and doing well.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, since Katrina, how do you look at the restaurant scene here? You know, every time I come back home, it seems like there's a new restaurant and, you know, seems like a lot of different things are going on. What's your take on what's happening?
Tom Fitzmaurice has this running calculation of how many restaurants we have. He would argue that even now, with a population a little more than half of what it used to be, or I don't know, maybe longer, bigger than that, but certainly 20-30% less than it used to be. There are more restaurants. My own theory is that a higher percentage of the people who live here now go out to restaurants. You know, between Mayor Nagin and President Bush and Governor Blanco, we've done a good job of minimizing the chance of poor people coming back to New Orleans. So it is easier to open a restaurant now, even with a smaller population, because there are more people who are willing and able to pay the prices that fine dining requires. So this is a very exciting food scene, both because the kind of locavore movement has helped chefs rediscover our own cuisine, but as is the case with barbecue, as we were talking earlier, and other national trends, we're finding that there's some new options in New Orleans. Additionally, the influx of Hispanic immigrants working post-storm has enlivened the Latino restaurant scene. And I think it's still somewhat in its infancy. But I like to think of it in terms of the days when New Orleans was briefly a Spanish colony, and there were a whole lot of people from Latin America coming here, in addition to all of the Haitians, of course, who are the backbone of the immigrant population. But the idea that this is reinvigorating that component of our culinary mix, and for all of the problems that this influx of workers signaled, the fact that our own people were not back and couldn't work, and that the government was actively recruiting people to do the jobs that we should have been allowed to do, notwithstanding all of that, the possibility for this reinvigoration of our culinary scene is very exciting.
Are there any restaurants in particular you're willing to say that you are really excited about? New spots.
Let's limit it to new, okay?
Yeah.
Adolfo Garcia of Rio Mar has done something very interesting with a place called Hi-Hat. He's bringing, in essence, a Southern meat and three restaurant to New Orleans, because Creole and Southern are similar but not the same. So that excites me. Interestingly enough, we got a real Italian restaurant scene here now with Alain Chaya at Dominica. And also, Adolfo Garcia is the owner and partner in a place called Amano, an Italian restaurant that is not doing what I call Sicilian Creole, but is doing really good regional Italian cuisine. The hamburger craze.
Yeah, I noticed that. What's that about?
I'm trying to get Adam's last name. Adam is a chef from here. Went and worked with the brilliant Linton Hopkins at the restaurant Eugene, Atlanta. Came back, opened up the company Burger. Adam Bergau, the chef at Patois, opened up True Burger. And then, what's my man's name? Opened up Cowbell. All uptown. Cowbell started off focusing on its burgers. Now it has a broader menu. But all kind of inexpensive fine dining, you know, quality chefs doing interesting things at reasonable price points, you know, and then of course Green Goddess, where you worked for a time, is doing innovative things, particularly with vegetarian dishes, which is something we often don't deal with here.
What, you know, when you're traveling, you get back, what is the dish that you crave?
What's funny about that is that my grandmother used to assume that I was starving, or at least not getting the right food when I was away. And of course, I'd learned to cook in part to avoid that. So I can tell you about my favorite New Orleans dishes. Hand down, the one that's my biggest favorite is gumbo. It is so emblematic of our people in this place. And I wrote an article for the Smithsonian Magazine about it recently, in which I finally laid out my gumbo philosophy. Shrimp po' boy, certainly a favorite. Beans and rice, I love, but it's kind of like, you know, if I'm somewhere where there's Tex-Mex or something, I'm getting other kinds of beans. And it ain't like home, but, you know, I love it. Or the Ethiopian version of lentils, or what the Indians do with various beans.
Why can't you get good gumbo in restaurants here?
Oh, I got a few theories. Chief among them, I think, is that at this point, you know, back in the days when Rudy Lombard and Nathaniel Burton wrote Creole Feast, there are all these black chefs and cooks in New Orleans restaurants. Certainly all the cooks and many of the executive chefs were black. which meant you're talking, for the most part, about people who hadn't been classically trained and who also had at least some sense of what the homemade article was like, and that's crucial in gumbo. I'm not especially interested in some average cook giving me his opinion on how his mother made a souffle. I doubt that they even made one. But in gumbo, his mother was an expert. Now, the number of New Orleanians in kitchens, certainly the number of black New Orleanians in the kitchen, and the number of people of whatever race who are from here and have a concept of what the home tradition was like, that's gone. So we have people who are not from here teaching people who are not from here, who have learned from people who are not from here, et cetera, et cetera. And I think the other thing that happened is that the Cajun craze meant that this idea of the dark roux and the seafoodless, okraless gumbo became emblematic of New Orleans when it never was and never should be. There's a very different Cajun gumbo tradition, and I argue that the two traditions shared little other than the word. And I think these days, restaurants, everybody's making a variation on what to me is an imperfect beginning. So, you know, I will like what is called gumbo in restaurants. I wouldn't call it that.
When you're writing for Treme, do you have your hand in any food culinary scenes or thoughts on that?
David Simon made the brilliant decision to hire Anthony Bourdain to write the restaurant scenes. And, you know, from his years in the kitchen, he dreams up disasters and nightmares that none of us could have dreamed up. The way the television thing works is everybody reads every script and puts in their two cents. And so there are a lot of the kitchen things that have a word of mine here or a sentence of mine there. And the non-kitchen scenes, probably more so, but, you know, the kitchen scenes are primarily Tony Bourdain. But I got to give it to Eric Obermeyer, David Simon, and Nina Noble, the other executive producer. They understand the importance of food in terms of New Orleans and in terms of a show that has New Orleans as its DNA. And so they look for ways of trying to incorporate food into the scenes, much as it's incorporated into life here.
What can we look forward to seeing from you in the future?
Hopefully another season of Treme. We're still waiting to hear about that. If not that, then perhaps we'll work on another television show. More work in the Oxford America. Some work in The Art of Eating, Ed Baer's excellent journal. And that's about it. More magazine and television writing.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show.
Helen, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
And thanks to Jack Inslee, the rest of the crew at Heritage Radio, and Roberta's. I'll see y'all next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.